This is the Beat Your Genes podcast, and my name is Nate G. I created this podcast to bridge together the science of evolutionary psychology and the clinical experience of Dr. Doug Lyle, all so that we can discover what life is all about. In each episode, Dr. Lyle analyzes and explains the psychology behind real-life situations from our listeners on topics like romance, friendship, work, family, health, and many more. We broadcast live every Wednesday at 8:30 p.m. Pacific Standard Time, which means you can call us during the show and ask Dr. Lyle a question. The U.S. number is 657-383-0751, or send in your question through the website www.beatyourgenes.org. All right, good evening, everybody. It's Nate G here along with Dr. Doug Lyle. Dr. Lyle, how are you doing this evening?
Good, good. All is well.
All right, fantastic. Well, we are ramping up for the end of the new year, so coming up soon. And so got a couple of deep questions. It's just me and Dr. Lyle, but we will have Dr. Jen Hawk on fairly shortly. So without further ado, let's just go right through the questions, Dr. Lyle. You ready?
And well, we'll try to make do without Jen. It won't be nearly as fun.
We will miss her.
It's all right. We'll miss her this week. All right, let's go ahead.
All right, dear Dr. Lyle. You've talked about the myelin sheath development, so I'd like to know, does the myelin sheath development also apply to more purely mental abilities, like reading and comprehension, or the ability to imagine and come up with inventive solutions to a problem? For example, how much can learning and practice be helpful in growing infants and children? Will a baby that is spoken to for 5 hours a day learn to speak significantly faster than one exposed to only an hour of language a day? Or are parents kidding themselves when they spend so much effort to give their child an edge in cognitive development?
A really fine question, and actually there's several different questions that are embedded here. I don't know the answers to some of them. I believe that I know, but I don't want to act like I know. The overarching question that the person is asking is whether or not a bunch of early practice will help essentially prepare the brain's, you know, evolution, in personal evolution, into being more effective. And the answer to that is no. So parents are kidding themselves that it doesn't matter what you're going to do to this little mind and how much you drill it. You're not going to turn it into anything fancy as a result of tremendous amount of effort. Now, there's the question, though. Another question in here is about myelin sheath versus the other. There's other ways that the brain changes its structure in order to become a more effective information processor. So that's the most fundamental level is at the level of the dendrites. That's the at least the most important part that we know. And I believe that that's going to be mostly involved with essentially the kind of information that you learn, declarative information, as opposed to motor patterns. So I think the myelin sheath is much more involved in motor patterns and skill development, specifically with respect to movement of your body in complex ways, very efficiently with low error. So I believe that the myelin sheath wrapping is mostly involved there and not so much involved with higher order brain function like algebra. I think that's going to be more dendritic. In either case, certainly wrapping myelin around motor development will make a difference. So if you aspire for your child to be a great concert pianist, then it's a good idea to start early. So just how many years you wrap the myelin and how well you wrap it would make a difference. I think it's of course absurd to be worrying about it, because I think a secondary consideration that overrides everything will be the person's motivation. So there is nobody motivated like someone who is naturally motivated to do something. So the sort of tiger mom attitude that we're going to turn this kid into a concert mistress, you know, violinist someday, and we're going to start at three is a brutal way to treat somebody in their early childhood, which almost in every case will wind up with a situation where the kid has no interest in what this thing is as time goes on. And so it doesn't matter how much you push early and wrap some myelin sheath. The truth of the matter is that people wrap myelin where they want to wrap myelin. the greats have a rage to master. They find something that is so inherently fascinating, some movement that they love. For Chris Evert, it was tennis. And so she just could not stay out of tennis, and she was just inherently fascinated with the geometry of tennis. With Tiger Woods, he was hitting a golf ball. And so there's people that just have a rage to master a given area, and that's what they do. So you can't make your kid into a chess champion, and you can't make them into a great anything. This will emerge. However, in principle, if you happen to have a situation where you had a rage to master and you had early childhood exposure, it might be helpful. So, for example, Mozart certainly had that situation. Of course, he winds up dead in an unmarked grave when he's 30. Okay, so the personality winds up causing a bunch of outcomes. Maybe getting murdered by Salieri. We don't know. Probably so. The conclusion that the person is that the questioner is asking is: are parents kidding themselves? The ones that are putting any pressure on kids to learn to get ahead are absolutely kidding themselves. It's going to turn out that essentially through childhood, through the early grades and into high school, about 20% of the variance in outcomes of educational achievement will be attributable to their environment. In other words, if parents are pushing and pushing and pushing, they can make a bit of an impact. They can probably increase a person's educational scores by maybe 10 percentile points or so. However, that all comes down in the first year, freshman year of college. So as soon as you move away and mom's no longer doing your homework, the tiger mom who's just, you know, pushing like crazy to get you into UC Berkeley, when the truth is that you're more of a UC Riverside kid, she may get you into Berkeley, but you're in trouble. you're now swimming with fish that have a little more chops than you have, and you're heading for the bottom of your class. That's because by the freshman year of high school, once the kid leaves home and they're actually on their own or they're studying subjects that mom and dad can't help them with, it turns out that there is no longer any environmental impact that's discernible. So the genes become the only systematic source of variance explaining outcomes. So that's it. So you're kidding yourself. Don't push your kids. Your job as a parent is to have your kids enjoy their existence, not become achievers. Okay, they will achieve things to the extent that they are motivated inherently to achieve them. You don't have to push them, and pushing them isn't going to do us any good.
Wow, it's fascinating. So that's a lot of implications to that, but. Yeah, to the parents that tell you, oh, well, you know, if I push them, you know, and they get 10% fancier, now they get into a school that's maybe a little bit above their ability, mm-hmm. But at least they got there.
Mm-hmm. Right.
What do you say to them?
Well, you know, that's one way to play life. So I can remember a counselor that I worked with at the University of Virginia was pushing her son to get into Duke. And I knew he wasn't that smart. And he was an athlete, and he was handsome. And I don't know if he ever got to Duke, but that was the idea, was to just get him in the door so that he could have the social connections and the cachet that would help him later in life. And, you know, I consider this to be an interesting concept that is probably a problem. I mean, it might not be a disaster, it might be fine. But this operates on the assumption that the world is so rigidly stratified that people are looking at your pedigree and they're not going to let you in the door unless you are at some level of the pedigree, and that there's no other way to signal the pedigree. This is ridiculous. People will go up against a Harvard-educated somebody and they'll beat them out in a job interview because of other things that are on the resume or just their interpersonal capabilities. And so obviously, your an academic pedigree can be useful, but it's by no means the only thing that guarantees any kind of success in the world. If that were true, nobody would be employed if they didn't come out of the Ivy League, for God's sakes. It turns out that, you know, we now know at this moment in American history that 96.4% of everybody that's looking for a job is employed. So that means that what you really need to be is you need to be safely at the fourth percentile and you're employed. So certainly if you're at the 20th percentile, you are way easily employed. And that means you don't even have a college education in terms of educational attainment. So you don't even have a high school diploma, for God's sakes. So the notion that we're going to try to cheat and slither or bluff our way into a higher category than we belong is, you know, one way to play the game, but it's certainly not necessarily justified by any outcome data. And also, I had a man that was as a result of like a military record, he got admitted to Harvard Business School, and in sort of midlife, he was maybe 40. And when I met him, he was maybe 55. And I had the same reaction that everybody had. He was having some employment difficulties. And so I kind of cross-examined him and he had an MBA. And I said, I don't know, I don't remember what I said. It was 20 years ago, but it would have been something like, oh, you know, where'd you go to school? Well, Harvard. Okay. Well, when you hear Harvard MBA on the other side of the table, you're thinking, basically, genius. Okay, this has got to be 145 IQ. It has to be easily in the top one percentile of the world's brains because there's no other way to get into Harvard MBA. And so I had that reaction, and he rolled his eyes and he said, that's the reaction everybody has. And it's not real. He says, I'm not an idiot, but I got in because of a military record and they kind of gave me a pass, but you know, I'm not that sharp basically. And so he'd been living his life dealing with the fact that everybody's expecting greatness out of him and he's just not delivering because this guy was a solid 125 IQ dude whose MBA should have come from, I don't know, Pepperdine in Malibu or something. You know, the should have been a decent solid school, but not Harvard. And so what we would think would be this magnificent advantage for his life turns out to be an ongoing source of frustration and confusion in his career. So yeah, I don't think that any parent who's, you know, desperately aiming at one notch higher in some academic food chain than your child really has the chops to do is doing that child any favors at all.
Yeah, you're reminding me of a book I read a long time ago by radio host Larry Elder.
Mm-hmm.
And he talks about a story of a philanthropist who mm-hmm. went around to disadvantaged kids and said that, you know, during high school, he said, I'm going to pay for your education. And he's going to get them into the best colleges and pay for everything all the way, the free ride.
Mm-hmm.
And it turned out that even despite that, they were able to get into certain colleges that they otherwise wouldn't have been able to get into. Mm-hmm. But they ended up dropping out at a far greater rate than they would have. And so it just set them up for, excuse me.
Yeah.
I don't think it set them up, but it's more so he was describing how they were in the college, but they really actually didn't, you know, couldn't have gone there on their own. And so therefore they were just dropping out and failing out. And it was just, you know, just another notch.
Fiasco.
Yeah, fiasco.
Totally fiasco. I saw this at Stanford as a prof, that I would see kids that were famous or legacies or spectacular athletes, and they're in my classes. And I remember very clearly one of the guys that was in my class. I had to fail him, and he went on to be an NFL lineman. And so he basically flunked his way, you know, through Stanford trying to weld together enough GPA points to remain eligible for long enough to display his wares on the football field at Stanford. But why? You know, why weren't you somewhere else? Quite frankly, I mean, not to disparage other institutions, but why weren't you at Washington State? Because if you were at Washington State, you're still in the Pac-10 or whatever they call it these days, Pac-16. I'm aging myself, but the point is you're still on in a nationally caliber football program, but you're in a classroom that you're very possibly can hack. And so I don't know, maybe he wears his Stanford alumni shirt, you know, proudly, but maybe he doesn't. And my attitude is, hey, you know, go to where you've authentically earned things. Don't be reaching for pseudo esteem that you don't deserve. And so that's, I would absolutely tell a parent that, you know, of which there are high percentages that will listen to this and have it go in one ear and out the other, as the esteem-seeking ferocity will push their children into situations where they're uncomfortable and they're in over their head. So, yeah, this winds up being an interesting question that is derived from the observation that even from the jump, there are highly conscientious, highly competitive parents that are pushing children to try to get competitive advantages, which is, of course, makes sense from a gene's eye point of view. It's like, hey, this is all about competition, for God's sakes. And, you know, we're out here to get the last genetic nickel on the table, and don't try to talk me out of it. The reason why I'm trying to talk you out of it and try to talk people out of this is as follows. And that is that the evidence says that the achievement levels will not change, that it's determined by genetics. So all that hustle and stress is for nothing. Second of all, it undermines the relationship between parent and child. So the parent becomes this watchdog sitting there, you know, with a monocle in one eye and a record book in the other. Essentially desperately trying to push these children ahead of their competitors in a dominance hierarchy. Yet, you know, it's just a very uncomfortable situation. And we are not in dire straits these days where 50% of the population is going to die. So you need to make sure that you're signaling that you're at least at the 51st percentile so that you don't miss the cut. Okay. No, there's places for everybody. At every level, there's people that can barely speak and can push a broom. So there are places for everybody, and there will be a place for everybody's kid. And so we don't need to be pushing and shoving and essentially having a ferocious process, of which I know is widespread in some communities far more than others. But this widespread fascination with the competitive hierarchy, it's a race to nowhere. And instead, we should be understanding that, you know, the first 20, 22 years of life, or whatever this is, your educational process is, that's like 25% of your life. That's a huge percentage of your existence. And so the notion here is to, if you're a parent, have this kid enjoy their existence. That is the purpose of we are subverting here. On this program, we are directing wisdom at the notion that the purpose of life is not to most effectively compete for gene survival. Instead, we're trying to subvert that genetic design and say what we're really trying to do is trying to optimize our life experience and maximize the moods of happiness. So that means looking at a problem like this, where the genes are saying compete, 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 cheat, 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 you know, shortcut, 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 whatever it is that we can do to, you know, maneuver ourselves into a little fancier stripe on our head. That makes a lot of sense that people would do that. And I'm here to tell you, well, that's a mistake. Okay, the mistake is for your kid to enjoy their existence maximally during these years that are just as valuable. Your child's 13th year is just as valuable as their 43rd year. It's actually more valuable because it's certain, because it's here right in front of us today, and we don't know that we're ever going to see 43. So today is very important, and the year that they have in eighth grade is very important for the enjoyment of the process itself. It is not simply a stepping stone towards, you know, genetic grandeur that's going to happen later. Forget about it. And so that's why the correct way to parent, okay, literally the right way to parent ethically, is to be trying to think through what's in, how to engineer the maximum happiness for that child that we can, while not subverting our own happiness. But if our own happiness is being derived from their genetic grandeur, then that needs to be stamped out with a ball peen hammer, okay? What I mean by them not compromising your happiness is don't work yourself to a bone to give the kid access to some soccer camp they want to go to if you can't easily afford it. Forget about it. There's compromises here. Your happiness is primary. Their happiness is also primary. Their long-term achievement is not primary. You leave that to them because they will be motivated by competitive issues that will arise in their future that will lead them to need to make the best decisions they can later. Let's not worry about it when they're a little kid or even when they're a pretty big kid.
Fascinating. Now, speaking of engineering and maneuvering, I read this, I think Jordan Peterson had this in one of his books. Jordan Peterson's got some great information out there, but I don't agree with everything that he says. But one of the things that I wanted to get your take on, Dr. Lyle, is the idea that we should be engineering our way so that we are the top 20th percentile of whatever village we're creating. And that way we feel like we're, you know, the most valuable coalition member or something like that.
That's interesting. It's bizarre. Sounds like the kind of thing that I've thought through it from time to time. So I've never read a sentence by Jordan Peterson, so I can't speak to anything else that he's ever said. But that's an interesting idea, and I can understand why that would make some sense. And so obviously, if you're in the bottom 10th percentile of any of a fancy coalition, you're feeling like you don't quite belong and you're about ready to get kicked out, a la my Harvard MBA guy. So I like that idea just as a general principle. I think that's true. I think that I can think about times when I played basketball, when I've been on a court with extremely competitive people and I'm the weak player on the team and the other team's looking to exploit me. That's not a good feeling to be in those circumstances. Much better to be in circumstances where I'm at the 80th percentile of people on the court, and I feel like I'm a contributor and I'm a real positive, you know, real asset.
Everyone wants you there.
Yeah. So I think that's actually a very interesting insight, and it reminds me of a moment in the brilliant movie As Good as It Gets, where Jack Nicholson, who is now adopted and loves this little dog, I forget what the dog's name. I can't remember the dog's name, but he's taken it to the vet or something, or he's taken it to drop it off for daycare, and he says, "Put him in with that one. Help his self confidence."
Verdell, yeah.
He was bigger than the other little dog. I just love that. So, I think that's a sort of a good general principle to swirl around in the back of your mind that you can't always execute on, but might not be a bad rule of thumb. I see some value in it. Mm-hmm.
Fascinating. Yeah, this has a lot of implications. I wonder, Dr. Lyle, if you think that there's a, you know, like you were talking about Mozart, and mm-hmm. how, you know, he ultimately succumbed to his personality, mm-hmm. It looks like. But do you think there's a perfect personality for, you know, these, you know, the kids who just get fascinated by something and just can't stop training?
Oh, yeah. I mean, there is one. And that is that these are they can't help themselves. They're just fanatic nuts, and that's they're part of what makes the world interesting. And so the it lets us see sometimes the limits of what humans are capable of doing when we run into these little people. And so the fair enough, but you don't. Just because they become world famous or county famous or whatever it is, and you see parents, you know, with their tongues out in envy, wishing that their child could be such a create such a spectacle. To my way of thinking is, hey, you know, it's kind of like, I don't know, it's kind of like going to going to Lion Country Safari and seeing the big bad lion that's in charge. It's like, hey, that's pretty cool. You know, there's somebody had to be the big bad one in charge, and that's the one. Somebody has to win, you know, the Olympic ice skating competition. And if it's Tara Lipinski, because she was a fanatic from the time she was two, so it is. And so the, but yeah, we don't morph people into this. That's not how it works. They have a rage to master, and it's just in them, and it's just a curiosity of the genetic code that it emerges.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. All right, fantastic. All right, our next question. Mm-hmm. Dear Dr. Lyle, I'm a private person, and I cringe when people air their dirty laundry or have what to me are very private conversations in social media, Facebook comment sections. I don't signal affiliation or loyalty the way most people do, and I tend to minimize advertising even when it would be seemingly beneficial. I recall declining someone wanting to write an article about me back in high school because, quote, I felt it was nobody's business. I realize I'll always be like this, but the way you and Jeffrey Miller talk about advertising opened up a new perspective. Do you think I'm missing out somehow? And if so, how could I improve where it matters?
Well, I can only, if we quickly scan down where it matters, if you're a salesman and this is your attitude, you're in trouble. If you're not shacked up, then it's a potential trouble. And if you don't have any friends, it's trouble. So you're driven to advertise in spite of the fact that you may be very introverted and not very open, i.e. a private person. So, yeah, I would just be a little bit glib and say, well, you it's a matter of what needs you have that are not being addressed and that you're getting signaled, tapped on the shoulder by your nervous system telling you that you've got a deficiency in an area of life. Now, in terms of missing out, the way the person asks the question, I would tend to think that they're not overly lonely or overly needy in any of those areas that aren't being addressed, or they'd be being pushed harder. And I would also agree with the inferences that they're making, that you're not changing it. So you could, obviously, if you are introverted and private and you don't have a date and haven't had one for 3.5 years, not a bad idea to go on an online dating site and choke out a profile and take a couple of pictures as flattering as possible and then see what happens, okay, and sort of enter the arena. But otherwise, I don't really see what you're missing out. In other words, many of us who are, I look at my own career, for example, pretty introverted, not very open. And as a result, not particularly well known. And relative to my skill level to a Dr. Phil, this is a joke, okay? But this is me. Like, I wouldn't have been comfortable out there in the world talking to huge amounts of people trying to be a spectacle. It's just, it's not me. I'm private, quiet, introverted, much like this person, very private person. And so this is the, does it hamper you professionally? Yeah, it does. Same thing with Alan Goldhammer. We really looked at where it is that we thought we wanted to kind of live our lives as young men. And we looked around, and we both grew up in Los Angeles, and we're both uncomfortable with large city atmosphere. And so He met his wife Jennifer, and they actually did a pretty systematic assessment of where it is that they thought they wanted to live their lives. And let me just say that where he lives on a street that you can't find his house. Nathan, you are up there for 4 years. Did you ever go to his house?
Once.
Ah, there you go.
Once, and he drove. So and I don't he think he could find it either.
Yeah, it's way off the road, and it's behind a guard gate. So this is how you have one of the greatest innovative ideas in the history of healthcare, and almost nobody knows about it. And that's because Alan, despite his complete capability of speaking, he's a very fine speaker, and he's tremendously intelligent. However, he is introverted, and so it has been in spite of himself that the world has gotten enough news about what it is that he does at True North that it's busy, and so finally. In his 60th year, and I'll go right ahead and name his age. It's fair, because he'll name mine right back. The point is that finally at 60, the world is beating a path to his door. And but it was a very slow dance. You know, this was not flash dance. This was just sort of one quiet educational exposure at a time. So this person's question... To answer your question, if you are introverted and you're not open, it will reduce your opportunities for exposure in multiple markets. That is true. And you are, quote, missing out. But I'm not really sure what's to be done about it, per se, because it is part of who it is that we are. And so had Alan been thrust more into the limelight early, he wouldn't have been comfortable. He would have been like a tortoise who would have pulled his head back. Because he can only handle the limelight and the noise for very brief periods of time, and then he's going to want to retreat. He could have never been Dr. Phil. Never would have happened.
Yeah, that the censors would probably have a feeling.
Yeah,
not that he swears at all, but
no,
he has some
no, but
very,
he's got a way of putting
examples.
Things. You
yeah.
got it.
Yeah. All right. Let's see, one more question, I think. So,
sure.
All right. Dear Dr. Lyle and Dr. Hawk, thank you so much for the valuable information. Look forward to great anticipation every show. Each and every episode solidifies previous learning, and the most recent episodes get even more interesting. So the question I've been having is, how do scientists go about measuring genes? How do they identify and associate them with human behavior? Is this something they can see with petri dishes and a microscope? And what would a behavioral scientist's day look like?
good questions. First of all, they can actually identify specific genes because they can actually read the code. So they have the ability to, they can read the stop and start in the DNA sequences. So they've identified what set of nucleotides represent a gene. A gene is a stretch of DNA that codes for a specific protein, and so they can number those genes in principle from 1 to 25,000 or whatever, however many of them there are in the human genome, something like that. Then after that, what they do is they can see when they're looking at a gene. They can actually, they've got it sequenced in terms of nucleotide pair by nucleotide pair. They can literally tell you that gene, this is how it this is what makes it up. And so they can also tell that same location on a different person's genome, they can see that there's a different gene there. And they can say, aha, that one has that gene, that other person has that gene. And it's going to turn out that you're going to see like the same genes often in a population. So let's just talk for fun here. So let's suppose that at a given place in the genetic code, there's a spot on chromosome 12, okay? And so we know that there's a gene there that's, oh, I don't know, 2,100,016 nucleotide pairs long. We know what it is. And we can see that a lot of people have exactly the same gene. And then there's other people that have exactly the same gene, but it's a different gene. So that we're going to call it gene A, gene B, gene C, gene D, gene E. Like there's 10 different genes that are commonly seen in the world's population at that specific site. Okay, so now we see what we got there. So now let's suppose that 28% of people have gene A and 16% of people have gene B and, you know, 11% of people have gene C and then 4% of people have gene D and another 4% have gene E, et cetera. And then 1% has gene K. All right. So 1% of people have gene K at that site. So now it turns out that we're running correlation coefficients on a million people about a bunch of stuff we know, like how smart are they, you know, whether they got diabetes, you know, whether or not they're left-handed, et cetera, all kinds of stuff. And then what we do is we're going to run the gene frequencies against all of these things that we know about people. And it turns out that, let's suppose, pancreas cancer happens 7% of pancreas cancer turns out to be coming from people with gene K, but only 1% of people in the population have gene K. So when you get the computer printout, you're like, whoa, what is that about? 7% of people that have that gene wind up with pancreas, or there's 7% of pancreas cancer cases. Whereas it shouldn't be that much. It's way higher than it would be expected by normal. If the gene was not associated with the creation of pancreas cancer, it wouldn't be showing up in 7% of the cases. It should be showing up in 1% of the cases. So this is how they do it. So they're not down in the lab. That's somebody else's job, you know, or some equipment's job or computer's job at this point. Identifying the genes and the different gene types at the different, you know, at the different locations on the genetic code. That's somebody else's job. But if you're a behavioral scientist, behavior geneticist, you're looking at correlation coefficients. That's one of the ways that they would go about doing their research. It's not the only way. So that's the way that looks. You're looking at a bunch of numbers and you're looking for striking correlations that look like, wait a minute, that doesn't look like it's due to chance. So because they're running so many correlation coefficients, an awful lot of things that look really exciting come popping up out of the data, but they are due to chance. And so then what you have to do is you got to go look at a new sample and see whether or not it's holding in a new sample or not. So that's how we track down clues. And if you saw something like that with gene K and pancreas cancer, it wouldn't be, quote, the cause of pancreas cancer, but it might be a contribute, you know, it's very likely to be a contributing cause of pancreas cancer. And so how that would be possible or why starts to be an interesting issue. So and maybe, for example, it could be you could get fooled if you just thought, oh, well, there's the cause of pancreas cancer, or there's a very significant issue. It could be that gene winds up being associated with openness, and it winds up causing people to smoke more, okay? And therefore, through the smoking, it causes more likelihood of pancreas cancer. So that would, I mean, none of this is true, by the way. But the truth is that that's precisely how it can work. So just because you see a correlation coefficient between a gene and a variable of interest doesn't mean that there's a direct causal pathway between that gene and the variable. The pathway could absolutely be convoluted and still be scientifically causal. So that's the gold mining process, or a part of the gold mining process that is part and parcel of modern behavior genetics and genetic science in general.
All right, Dr. Lau. Well, appreciate that explanation. That clarifies a little bit in my head about it. All right. Well, thank you very much again for answering these wonderful questions and with the wonderful answers. And Dr. Lyle, we'll look forward to talking to you again next week.
Very good. We'll see you soon, Nathan.
Thanks for listening. If you like what you hear, subscribe, write us a review, or share this podcast with a friend. To send in a question or read more about the show, you can visit our website at www.beatyourgenes.org. Until next time, this is Nate G. and Dr. Lyle with Beat Your Genes, an evolutionary psychology podcast for finding happiness in the modern world.